There is a perennial trade-off between the competing interests for whether we dig stuff from out of the ground or if we just let it be. Is the damage to the beauty, environment, and culture worth the riches in minerals, building materials, and energy that it costs to extract? There are plenty of instances where that trade-off has clearly come at the cost to nature, but then as well, perhaps even more, where the environmental trade-off has been worthwhile. After all, we live in a built environment. The sheer quantities of sand mined every year to fuel the concrete we interact with scars permanently riverbeds, creates water scarcity, and pollutes so much of the world. Australia alone has dug out thousands, if not millions of tons of iron ore to then sell to a China who goes on to build, in the worst case, ghost cities that no one even inhabits. Oil, the great carbon slick that we've so feverishly extracted from the earth, has offset the carbon cycle under which we evolved. And depending on who you believe, that single cost to the environment may end up being the end of us. But then as well, that same oil, that same concrete, that same iron ore, and that same everything else has also enabled the innovation and prosperity from which our growing population benefits. In 1900, there were 1.6 billion people. And today, there's over 8. That's an insane growth, which has an immense hunger for the very same stuff which ruins our environment. And so, as you can see, a rather tricky trade-off, and the central one which Earn the Shader runs directly towards in A War Below. The electrification of the economy is, on the one hand, really good. Rather necessary, in fact. It means we can move away from consuming the carbon-rich oil into our atmosphere. But it also means that we're going to need way more other stuff from under the ground than we currently even know about. Copper, lithium, cobalt, and literally hundreds of other rare earths are all necessary components of batteries, electric cars, trucks, boats, even leaf blowers. And this is for a scale of 8 billion, soon to be 9 billion people. If a sacred religious site is built atop enough copper to secure your domestic supply, should you mine it? If thousands of tons of lithium is built under a unique flower, almost certain to go extinct if you extract it, should you do it? And if you decide to play by the environmental rules while everybody else doesn't, are you doing what's best in the short term at the cost of what's best in the long? These questions consume the book and as well, this conversation. So here is veteran energy journalist for Reuters and author of The War Below, Ernest Shader. How did it feel getting Daniel Juergen's endorsement?
I was really fortunate that he took the time to read the book and to provide some nice feedback on an early draft and to share his thoughts on the book. Obviously, an expert in the field of energy broadly, wrote the seminal book on the oil and gas industry, several seminal books on the oil and gas industry. And to have his feedback on The War Below was great, because the entire energy economy, of course, is shifting. It's still going to use a lot of oil and natural gas, but increasingly we're going to be needing a lot more copper and lithium and other critical minerals. So it really behooves us all to have a broad conversation about where we want to get those critical minerals. And Dan and his work at CERAWeek and S&P are key parts of those conversations.
Have you spent much time with him?
So I do, sort of like many energy journalists, live at the CERAWeek conference every year. And I use that word on purpose, live, because it tends to be 5 days in a row, sometimes 6 or 7, depending where you're at this hotel for about 12, 13, 14, 15 hours a day.
Yeah.
Just sort of running and ragged. And that's a testament to the high caliber of speakers and guests that Dan and his team get for CERAWeek. So we all sort of tend to embed there as we live there for the better part of a week. But he's also a great commentator on various energy changes, whether that's in geopolitics or in technology or in other areas. And so fair to say that he is someone widely respected and look up to in the space for his well-earned expertise.
Totally. I mean, this is a bit of a tangent far too early on, but geothermal energy, do you guys covering the oil and gas stay abreast what's happening there at the moment and take interest in it?
I think geothermal is a pretty interesting space. I think there's some kinks still to be worked out. I don't know as much about geothermal as I do critical minerals, but I think there's certainly core competencies when it comes to exploring subsurface geography that many mining companies or oil and gas companies have. And there's a lot of interesting potential there for geothermal going mainstream.
Totally, right? Okay, yeah. But nonetheless. So the book, it's about this ongoing debate of trade-offs for whether we should pull these resources out of the ground. And can you please present both sides of the argument and all the complexity for why it's actually not so simple of a question?
Sure. So the book is called The War Below: Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. And at its core, the book is an exploration of choice. You know, my firm belief, Ryan, is that you get to ask your audience one question when you write a book. And the question that I'm asking here of the audience is, what are the choices that we're willing to make if we want to go green, if we want this energy transition, if we feel that climate change is serious and we need electric vehicles, solar panels, wind turbines, and other green energy devices to help fight climate change? And on top of that, if we also want all of the electronic gadgets and gizmos that are increasingly powered by lithium-ion batteries and other critical minerals, cell phones, laptops, etc., then we have to be having a discussion about where we want them. And the book builds off of my work in my day job at Reuters, where I wrote about a lot of proposed mines in the United States and elsewhere that were facing various degrees of opposition due to one reason or another. And the more I reported on these areas, I started to see a cohesive thread for a narrative emerge. Because in my previous life, I used to cover the oil and gas industry, and I think a lot of folks would fall into what I would say is pretty much just two camps. Either you tend to be okay with extracting oil and natural gas, or for various reasons, you might say, no, we've got to stop it, whether that's for climate reasons or other reasons. But with critical minerals, 98, 99% of the people that I would interview in my day job would be broadly supportive of just the need for these critical minerals. The tension rose around, where do we actually want to get them? And so therein lied a very interesting area that I thought, as a journalist, as an author, to push into here. Are there some places that are too special to mine? What are the standards for mining in places where we think it's okay to mine? Who should be able to say yes or no to a certain project, whether that's for indigenous reasons or ecological or environmental reasons? What are the deciding factors here? And we're not having this broad discussion right now. And so I really wanted the reader, especially in the United States, but more broadly, us as citizens of the world, to be really wrestling with these topics. And so that's what I bring to the book. The book goes through several proposed projects across the United States and the world that would supply lithium and copper and nickel and cobalt and rare earths that are so vital for the energy transition, but they all face various levels of opposition due to one degree or another. And I purposely don't take a stance on whether or not these forms of opposition are right or wrong. That's not my job, I don't think, here. But what it is my job to do is to bring to the reader the human stories of the people that are affected by the choices we're making, or more commonly, the choices we're not making right now. We just sort of assume we show up to a store and the product will be there without thinking through the very long supply chains that helped bring it to us. And I think, Ryan, if the coronavirus pandemic taught us anything, it's that these really long supply chains probably are not feasible anymore at all. I mean, it was 4 years ago this month that we discovered as a world, and especially here in the United States, that very few places made masks, that sort of most basic of medical equipment yet necessary during the pandemic. And I think that's just one product. Then you extrapolate it across the millions of electronic devices that are powered by all these critical minerals, and you start to see the huge implications for the supply chain. And it's about so much more than just electric vehicles. I think too often people just sort of take the issue and are like, oh yeah, I don't own an EV. I'll never buy one. Why does this affect me? Well, I'll tell you what, you probably got a cell phone. You probably got a laptop. You probably have a bunch of other lithium ion powered devices in your house and you don't even realize it. And these are just sort of basic goods, never mind things that help us fight climate change. So that was all this stuff that sort of, you put it into a pot, and that was what I, you know, hit boil on in the stove, if you will, to help really build this cohesive narrative. And I was really fortunate to be able to spend time with folks on all sides of this issue here and point out for the reader that there's more than one side when it comes to this critical minerals debate. There's folks that might be supportive of a mine, but not want it here. Or they might be broadly supportive of the energy transition, but they say for indigenous rights reasons, we shouldn't have this project here. And they're all different angles. And so what I wanted to do with the book is tell the human story as well here, because human beings are complex, and it's important to not demonize or caricature one side or another or any of the sides, but I really wanted to paint for the reader who these people are, show them 3D, warts and all, so that folks can help form their own opinion about these complex areas.
Okay, then, so let's set up the ledger. What's the case for pulling it out of the ground despite the cost to culture or the environment? And then I'll ask you the other side, but first, what's the case for just pulling it out despite the cost?
Sure. The main narrative that I, excuse me, the main story that I build the narrative around is that of the Rhyolite Ridge Lithium Project, which is about 200 miles north of Las Vegas. And this is a proposed mine that would supply much of the lithium needed for the United States for its lithium needs. It also is, unfortunately, home to a rare flower found nowhere else on the planet. And so the mine may affect the flower, probably would affect the flower if it were developed. The case for developing it, of course, is this lithium could really help fight climate change. Could hugely help the United States and global efforts to reduce its fossil fuel usage, to reduce carbon emissions, and to move toward a greener, cleaner economy. Just combining the two words there. But there, of course, lies the tension, right? I mean, if we develop this mine, would the flower go extinct? If we did nothing, wouldn't the flower go extinct anyhow because of climate change? And wouldn't the flower be affected by climate change? Probably. But the main argument, of course, is to take it out. And who gets to make that decision? Who should and should not be involved in that decision process? You know, I think that's for our regulators, for us as voters, to be able to decide. But clearly, there's a need for lithium. When we just look at the sheer demand for demand projections out through the end of the decade, even with a short-term blurb the past 5 to 6 months, we still see very, very strong demand for lithium going out to the end of the decade, especially because this is so much more than just transportation.
More hard statistics for why we need the lithium, why we need the copper.
So just take this, Ryan. When we look at just sheer numbers, the United States President Joe Biden has said that he wants to help electrify much of the United States government fleet. We've got the Paris Climate Accords that set out these really ambitious targets for much of the people that signed the Paris Climate Accords to go green. But in order to reach the goals set out by the Paris Climate Accords, we are going to have a global demand increase for lithium and graphite alone more than 4,000% by 2040. That's staggering. That's just 16 years from now that we're going to have a 4,000% increase just for lithium and copper. Like, that's crazy. Excuse me, lithium and graphite. When we think about copper, I mean, in 2022, global annual production was about 25 million tons. That's going to have to double to more than double to 53 million tons by 2050 if we're going to actually reach the Paris Climate Accord targets. And that's just for three metals right there, lithium, graphite, and copper. We haven't even talked about nickel or many of the other metals and minerals that are needed for this transition. With oil and gas, I think people are used to thinking about the supply chains for those, even if they might not fully understand them. But with critical minerals, it's so much more complex because you've got various different ways to produce many of these critical minerals, whether that's in a processing plant or a smelter. You have different parts of the world where it comes from, and it might be extracted from, say, northern Chile, but then you have to take the lithium across the Pacific Ocean to, say, a processing plant in China, where then it's you put into a form that can be used in a cathode, which is part of a battery, and then put into a battery pack, and then maybe shipped back across the Pacific Ocean to an electric vehicle plant in maybe Nevada before it's then shipped to, say, Florida, where it's finally sold as an electric vehicle. I mean, that long journey also speaks to the huge greenhouse gas emissions that just come up with the current supply chain as it exists right now. So there's not only a sheer demand increase, but there's also huge questions about where we actually want to be producing these. I mean, if the goal is to help fight climate change, should we really be shipping minerals across the world to help fight climate change? I don't know. It seems paradoxical to me.
Hence the tension. Do we want?
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. So just the sheer demand for it. This is the Steelman case for why we should pull this stuff out of the ground, irrespective of the cost to culture and environment. But what about the other side of the coin? Why should they stay in the ground because of the cost to culture and environment?
Sure. I mean, I think it gets back to the question of who decides what is important and what are the choices we're willing to accept. One of the chapters in The War Below looks at the proposed Resolution Copper Project in Arizona. This is about an hour east of Phoenix, and this is a massive copper deposit that would supply more than a quarter of the United States demand for the red metal if it were developed. But the type of geological deposit that this copper is in and the way that it would most likely be mined would cause this giant crater more than 2 miles wide that would destroy a site of religious importance to the San Carlos Apache people. And so the question is, should that copper be extracted to fight climate change if it destroys a place where some people worship their deities? The argument that I often hear from supporters is that if you had found lithium underneath St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, for instance, would you dig it up in order to get the lithium to fight climate change? Would you do this for, you know, a mosque in Mecca or Medina? The answer is probably no to all of those. And those are for two major global religions that we're just talking about there. We don't have more than a billion people that worship the San Carlos Apache way of life. But nevertheless, the book is at pains not to take a position on whether or not it should be, but really to have folks think through, okay, like, are we going to allow this mine to be developed if it would destroy a place that some people consider religiously important and culturally sensitive? And who decides what is religiously important and culturally sensitive? And should everyone be able to say, hey, I find this patch of land culturally sensitive and religiously important, therefore we shouldn't touch it?
So then how do you go about answering that question?
That's the trillion-dollar question, right, Ryan? It's like, who decides? And I think we need to be having a discussion broadly as Americans, as citizens of the world, about whether we think there are some places that are too special to mine, and really sort of dive into these sticky questions. I mean, what does it look like to get what's called free, prior, and informed consent from indigenous communities? Does that mean that everyone in a tribe has to say yes? Does that mean that you just need to get the tribal leadership, but not maybe the cultural leaders? What does that look like from a community? And especially in North America, communities that have been disabused of the economic and social developments that have happened across the continent for the past 200 years, and in many cases have actually been harmed by some of those developments. So what does it look like to have an ethical and a socially responsible approach to developing those assets? I think this is what we need to be thinking through. And I really bring this to the reader. The core argument of the book is you have to be deciding what you want, because we're not thinking about those issues right now. And inaction is a choice as well. So it's not as easy anymore to just keep our heads in the sand and say, oh, we'll just show up to the store and get our stuff.
To draw a direct parallel to that exact example of the Apache indigenous land in Arizona, talk about what Rio Tinto did to the Pilbara in Australia.
Well, that is quite the saga. Yes, it's so Rio Tinto and BHP are the two companies that would like to develop this Resolution Copper Project in Arizona. Rio Tinto is the majority owner and the developer of the project, and so it's basically in the driver's seat. The company is a global mining company. It has large iron ore operations in Western Australia. And a few years ago, they wanted to expand an iron ore mine and got all the permits for it, had the legal okay, the legal green light. But unfortunately, as they were expanding this mine, they destroyed these caves that were basically culturally and historically important to indigenous peoples in this part of Australia. And these were caves that had been inhabited for thousands of years. There were many historical artifacts there. And so much of these people's history was destroyed as this mine was expanded. And the outcry was so harsh, Rio Tinto ended up getting rid of its CEO and the chairman of its board. So that shows you how sensitive Rio's investors and the entire investment community was to how the mining industry interacts with indigenous peoples. And the new CEO has vowed change. He's vowed dialogue. He has told me for the book and others that he's going to seek free, prior, and informed consent from the San Carlos Apache people in Arizona. But certainly what happened in Australia does weigh on this whole discourse and does affect what's going on in Arizona and the United States.
Talk about how brazen they were in coming to that decision and blowing up the cave.
Well, the decision to blow up the cave in Australia was a legal one. Rio Tinto did follow the permitting process. It was not a wise one in hindsight. It definitely cost the jobs of its CEO and the chairman of its board. So it was, one, could they have sought more engagement? You know, I think there are many would have said that they should have sought more engagement. The company now in hindsight says it should have sought more engagement. But it colored how the rest of the indigenous communities across the world certainly see the company. And it definitely has had an effect on how the company's attempts to produce this copper in Arizona are perceived by not only indigenous communities, but their supporters.
To reframe the question of the trade-offs between whether we pull it out of the ground or not, the mining companies tend to be the villains in all of this story. So I just wanted to ask you how villainous you say these companies are, or are they actually admirable for pulling the exact stuff out of the ground, which is going to electrify the economy and give us all the things that allow for modernity?
Well, human beings are complex and they are everywhere, obviously. You're a human, I'm a human. I was really focused here in the writing of this book to get to know the people on all sides of this debate and help to paint a full picture of what makes them tick so that the reader can determine for her or himself where they stood on these complex issues. So it is true, we are going to need gargantuan amounts of copper and nickel and cobalt and other critical minerals just going out the next 5, 10, 15 years. The demand projections are through the roof. So who's going to supply those? Certainly it's going to be the mining industry, partially the recycling industry, but mostly people that put holes in the ground, to be, you know, sort of basic in my metaphors there. Those people that oppose them have very strong reasons for why they're opposing it. So I think it was important to chronicle them as well. And all sides have a stake in this issue. And what I was really focused on in writing The War Below is telling the full picture of the people that are involved here on the mining industry side, the groups that support them, the NGOs, and there are many NGOs that do actually support good mining, as well as those that oppose them. And I didn't want to caricature any side here. I wanted folks to see the fullest picture of who folks are in the mining industry, as well as the environmentalist or the conservationist that might oppose them for various reasons. That was my North Star really here.
If you want to domesticate the supply chains, what is the case for not pushing the boundary on cultural issues, on environmental issues? Say, for instance, as you're coming to make a decision, you have to cross a boundary. And if your first boundary you cross is, we decide, yes, we want to domesticate these supply chains, you have to then make concessions further down. So, I mean, you've done so much research. You've lived in this space for so long. How do people rationalize this and justify the questions and come to the right conclusions?
I mean, we're not really right now in the United States or really elsewhere. And I would share your curiosity as to why we're not, if we have set these goals for ourselves.
Right, right.
It doesn't make sense. And part of what I push into in the book, in The War Below, is the fact that Washington, D.C. has these aggressive goals for electrification, but at the same time has no clear sense for how a mine gets approved. I mean, think about this, Ryan. Like, say you just owned 1,000 acres in Nevada. How would you go about starting to mine it if you think it contains a big reserve of critical minerals? It's a wildly myopic process that is so confusing for anyone to navigate through. I mean, there's a reason why there's a cottage industry of lawyers that specialize just in U.S. federal mine permitting.
Right,
it's crazy. And so there's no clear sense from Washington about how to get a mine approved. Some of these mines that I chronicle in the book have been on the drawing board for more than a decade, and there is no end in sight. There's not even an end in sight for when you could get a clear no. So time and time again, I had heard from people on all sides of this issue, not just in the mining industry, but and many actually conservationists that oppose them, they want more clarity from federal regulators in the United States around mine permitting. And I should say that folks I talked to for the book in Canada and parts of Australia, while they're sort of looked up to as sort of the holy grail by U.S. mining companies, they would often say that the regulators in those countries are not exactly on the same page either here. So governments should be speaking with one voice about what are the rules in place here. I mean, Ryan, take this. The law that governs mining in the United States has been on the books since 1872. It hasn't really been updated a lot since then. And this was a law that was designed to help expand development of the Western United States, at that time very sparsely populated. And the law allows mining companies to take critical minerals out of land that taxpayers own without paying royalties, which is crazy when you think about it.
That is crazy.
Because we expect oil companies to pay royalties to the federal government, and they do. They don't like it, but they do because they have to. And so these are laws and regulations that have been on the books for a really long time. And the Western United States is populated now. It is developed. Some might argue it's overdeveloped. And should the law be updated? It's a very antiquated and confusing law to many people. And so having Washington speak with one voice, at least here in the United States, was one thing I heard again and again and again. Because if we're going to go electric, we've got to have more sources of the minerals that help us go electric. And right now, those things are not in harmony. Those ideas are completely diametrically in opposite areas right now. One arm of the U.S. federal government doesn't, or seem to be, no. One arm of the U.S. federal government doesn't seem to be acting in concert with the other one.
Is that whole legalese confusing by design, so a few in the know actors can really take advantage of it, or confusing as a consequence of just so much iteration of all these competing interests trying to get ultimately the stuff under the ground?
I would say that you have a lot of voices in a democracy, and a democracy can be messy, and certainly there are going to have to be avenues to recognize and respect that the many different voices in a democracy need to be heard. And I'm not advocating for a lessening of that approach, but having clarity of rule, having clarity of purpose and goal insight is a great way to send a signal to not only the people that supply the building blocks of this energy transition, but people on all sides of the debate that here are the rules of the road, if you'll forgive the pun, and here's how we're going to operate a mine permitting process, how we're going to oversee a mine, and what are the standards in place by which we expect a mine of the 21st century to operate. I mean, the United States used to have a Bureau of Mines, for instance, that would oversee a lot of mines, and it got rid of that in around a budget cuts in the 1990s. And so there are still some federal agencies that oversee mines, but it also helped to do a lot with R&D, and that function is gone. And so there's really just not an ethos in the United States right now that it cultivates or encourages mining. I mean, most people, when they go into colleges in the United States, don't want to study mining. There's only a handful of schools in the United States that actually teach mining engineering, and they are hungry for students. So right. If any of your listeners want a free ride to a mining engineering school, I can probably connect you with a professor that would love to talk.
Oh, that's cool. It's also, I find it to be a pretty compelling industry, but that just might be the Australian in me.
I think when you're born as an Australian, they sort of stamp a respect for the mining industry onto
you. Yeah, I think so. So there's, the book doesn't hinge around this point, but a very prominent theme in the book is this buckwheat flour problem, which is that a mine has, and you mentioned it earlier in the conversation, but a mine has been held up from being extracted because there is a totally unique flour species that exists there. I wanted to ask you what you think. I know you've been very careful to say, like, I'm just here presenting both sides, but do you think that the extinction of one specific flower would be worth the extraction of the stuff underneath the ground there, which is the case here?
So I'm going to give you an answer that might not completely satisfy you, but I really do feel that my job here as the author was to present all sides of this issue and say to the audience, well, what do you think? Should this flower go extinct? Or should we allow for the preservation of this and other species out there? Like, does the flower matter more than the lithium, or can they be extracted at the same time? What are the choices you're willing to make here? I obviously do have my own opinions on this situation here, but I really felt that it was important to have that central argument for the reader. The central argument that I'm saying, that I'm shaking the reader through the page, is what are the choices you're willing to make?
Right.
Should the flower go extinct, or should we mine the lithium? Can both be done at the same time? And if we let the flower go extinct, what does that mean about biodiversity and our approach to the planet in general? Mm. Is it a flower this time, or, you know, a panda bear next time, or a mountain lion next time, or XYZ species? What are the choices we're willing to make? We're not having those right now.
But the book achieves that, right? It does make you realize that there are really genuinely two sides to this. But you now doing an interview about it, separated from the book, are you willing to share what you think might be the right solution there?
I think me sharing my opinion on this is my lowly opinion would matter very little compared to us as citizens of the world needing to debate whether or not we're going to let things like this happen. Like, nice. I hope the book sparks a broader conversation about the choices that we have to be making here. Mm. I mean, sure. I mean, I have my opinion on whether or not the flower should go extinct or if we should let it go extinct. But I don't think that really matters as much in the grand scheme of things because, you know, I'm just one person. I mean, I want millions of people to be having the debate about what are the things that we need to be doing if we have this energy transition accelerate.
Fair enough. I don't want to make you uncomfortable by forcing the issue.
No.
But I mean,
when I used to cover the oil and gas industry, people would ask me all the time, fracking, good or bad? Mm. And actually, I would give a similar answer. I would never directly say whether I thought fracking was good or bad, because I would always point out to people that, well, you're wearing a polyester shirt or you're drinking out of a plastic cup or you came here in a taxi powered by gasoline. So I don't know. You tell me, fracking good or bad.
Right.
There's just no easy answers here.
Totally, totally. No easy answers. And I hear you making the argument that if we allow a unique, genuinely, like definitionally unique flower to go extinct, what is the line? Do we then allow a bird to go extinct? Do we then allow, you know, a great marvel like the panda to go extinct? Hear that. But there's also a ongoing debate every single time that happens. And it's not like there's no precedence already for us, you know, having species go extinct. 99% of all species that ever existed have gone extinct on this planet. I mean, as what the scientists say. And, you know, like life is constantly changing. And we obviously, that's what sentiment is. But we want things to stay as they were and as we remember them. But it is an unshakable reality of life that it is constantly in change. And part of that means making these sort of trade-offs. You know, like when you said earlier, if a great lithium deposit was discovered under St. Peter's in the Vatican, I think pretty unanimously people would agree that we wouldn't want to dig that up. The reasons being is that the Vatican is valuable to billions of people, irrespective of your religion to a degree. And so it's a very hard question to ask, but is the same value worthwhile to an indigenous community in the Pilbara? And, you know, from there come sort of uncomfortable questions because it's like, can they really be treated equally? I don't know. To me personally, I remember when that happened in Australia and I met my old friend and she was just like, livid about it because she had a bit of an insider track. I forget why, but she somehow knew what was going on. And she said they totally knew about it. They knew it was a 50,000-year-old site and they just blew it up because they could, you know, and Australia was so used to not treating its indigenous people well that they thought there would be sort of only a small little reaction from the left, but largely people would be okay with it. Obviously they were proven wrong. Anyway, just a lot to say that these are, I suppose, the questions that you want to be risen to the surface from the book.
Most definitely. I mean, there's no easy answer here, right? And I think the example in the Pilbara with Rio Tinto is a great example of people coming together and saying, we're not going to allow this. A huge discourse in Australian society and really global society around whether or not this was right or wrong to destroy this site that was so important to the PKKP people for thousands of years, you know, whether or not you had a permit or not. And so this is a great example of the kind of conversation that can happen when people come together and think through what the mining industry actually does or doesn't do. You know, I think the mining industry has been sort of seen as this boring, staid, you know, amalgamation of people for hundreds of thousands of years. You know, it's one of the oldest industries in the world. You just make a hole in the ground and you get rock out of it. You know, it's obviously much more complex than that, but that's hasn't really changed that much since the dawn of time. But we obviously rely on it. And just because we rely on it and it's sort of old and antiquated, we have put it sort of out of sight, out of mind, and don't actually think through the ramifications of how the mining industry operates. And it's about so much more than just moving rock. You know, the mining industry is one of the biggest users of water on the planet. You know, more than 70% of the water in Chile, for instance, goes to the mining industry. That's crazy. Insane. Yeah. Especially when you consider that Chile is also a huge agricultural country. It exports a ton of blueberries and other crops to the rest of the world. So most of the water doesn't go to farming, it goes to mining. And this is just one country. Now think about places like in the Western United States that are in perpetual droughts, but are still huge copper producing regions. You know, people aren't thinking about these things right now. And so I'm actually sort of encouraged by the PKKP example in Australia, because it showed that, you know, average everyday people can really grapple with the complexities of the mining industry and decide for themselves what they want to happen as a result.
It's a phenomenal example, and it's obviously mirrored in Australia again, an extremely drought-ridden country where water scarcity is a genuine thing, even if you're in the cities, yet you'll have absurd amounts to dig out coal from the ground to then send it to China. You know, so you get some narrow economic interests where that's a giant incentive, but it doesn't necessarily feed everybody. On the subject of the byproduct of mining, what about this? This is in my notes. 50 million tons of waste. Could that be right? What is that in reference to?
50 million tons of electronic waste.
Oh, is that that's insane.
Yeah.
So
each year about 50 million tons of electronic waste is generated, and that's an amount roughly equivalent to every single commercial airplane ever built every single year. That's a lot of electronic waste. And so, Ryan, I'm sure you've got one. I know I have one, and that is a drawer in your house somewhere filled with old cell phones, old cell phone chargers, and other old pieces of electronics. Now just magnify that by the millions and millions of households across the world, and you get a sense of how many critical minerals are just sitting in your house waiting to be recycled. So recycling is a key part of the war below, and I really wanted to dive into this because if we're going to have an energy transition, recycling, of course, has to be part of the discussion. With oil and gas, after you combust them for energy, they're spent, they're gone. But all of these critical minerals can be reused. Lithium doesn't lose its ability to hold a charge just because it's been in a battery for 10 years. So if you can economically extract that lithium and then reuse it in a new lithium-ion battery, well, then you're off to the races. And it's not just about electric vehicles, although that'll obviously be a huge part of the equation. It's about all of these gadgets that are in your drawer, my drawer, everyone's drawers at their houses, and the old laptops and other equipment that should and can be recycled. And so this chapter in The War Below looks at the logistics that actually goes into how do we encourage people across the world to support an ecosphere of recycling. And surprisingly, the most expensive and actually most dangerous part of the recycling industry is transportation. Because think about it, you're transporting something that is by definition charged. It's a spent battery. It might have 1 or 2% in there, but you know, you magnify that over, say, 1,000 cell phone batteries in a rail car that's going to a recycling facility, then you really start to see, gosh, like that's probably why you could have thermal runaway or a battery that sort of spontaneously combusts. And when you've got one sitting in a big container of 1,000, well, you just, you know, you can sort of see the ramifications there. And so I explore this concept in the book of maybe building more recycling plants closer to consumers. And what would that look like? And would that decrease this pain point in the recycling current recycling ecosphere right now, which is transportation? And so the chapter looks at the history of two companies, Li-Cycle as well as Redwood, that are building recycling systems in North America. And they each have different approaches to recycling, but Li-Cycle has created what's called a hub and spoke model, where they create many different spokes, sort of almost like an airline network, at various parts across the continent. And they collect these old batteries and then they take them to the spoke facility where it's broken down into what's called black mass. It's basically shredded battery components. And that black mass does not have a charge anymore. It's been decharged, so to speak. and then that can be taken to a central facility where then can be further broken down into the critical mineral parts. This is an interesting strategy I found, and I was curious about the history of the company. And so this chapter looks at the history there. But there are recycling companies across the world. There obviously are not that many electric vehicle batteries en masse yet to have a fully what's known as circular economy, the idea that maybe we'll get to a point at some point in the future where we're able to stop mining altogether and just recycle old batteries and make new ones. I don't know when we're actually going to get there.
That'd be something.
A lot of different estimates. Yeah, it's the goal, right? I mean, companies like Apple and other major manufacturers are very public, actually, about their goals to end the modern mining industry as we know it. And some mining companies have even acknowledged that at some point they will dig their last hole in the ground. But when will that be? I don't know. 2050, 2060, 2070? I think anyone that tells you a specific date, it doesn't really know what they're talking about.
As long as the sum costs of the waste are less than the cost to recycle it, I mean, those economics will just really never align. And right. So this is a big part of it as well. Yeah. Are people comfortable with paying more for these goods because it's imposed on them by legislation about where it's mined and the quality that you get?
So I'm going to back into answering your question by referencing lead acid batteries. At least here in the United States, there has been a whole system set up in previous decades around lead acid battery recycling. And so lead acid batteries are used in internal combustion engine vehicles. They are the main power mechanism for that. When that battery reaches its end of life, the consumer buys a new one. And what the consumer doesn't realize is there's a small charge affixed to the purchase of that new battery that funds this entire ecosystem for recycling lead acid batteries. And so that battery does not go to a landfill where it's never seen from again. It actually is repurposed and reused, and the parts are used to make new lead acid batteries. It's been around for a while. It's this well-oiled machine. I'm curious about what could that look like for electric vehicle batteries or lithium-ion batteries in general. You know, should a charge be affixed to a lithium-ion battery that could help fund an ecosystem for recycling these batteries? What would that look like? Would consumers be okay with that? Because, you know, I think if you were to ask most people, especially in the United States, do they know they pay a small percentage for lead acid battery recycling? They probably wouldn't even know. In some states here in the United States, like I grew up in the state of Maine, for every bottle you buy, whether it's a beer bottle or a soda can bottle, you pay 5 cents, and that helps fund the recycling infrastructure in the state. So what would that look like for an EV battery? And how would that work on a practical level? Because some EV batteries can have different chemical components. Like some might have more nickel-heavy chemistries and some might have more iron-heavy chemistries. So how would that work? So I think there's some practical things to figure out as well there. But I think having the philosophical question about would this be set up and could policymakers be instituting this, I think is a good one to have. And I think perhaps in time we'll start to see maybe some battery chemistries be mandated. We're starting to see it with charging infrastructure right now, where we've got a billion different plugs for an electric vehicle, for instance, or even your cell phone. And we're starting to see some host governments across the world mandate specific types of plugs. So are we going to see that for battery chemistries? And what would that mean for recycling? I think these are really curious areas to push into in the next 5-10 years and explore.
Forgive me if this is a violent non sequitur. I don't know if non sequitur is the right word, but a tangent that's not related to what you were saying.
Sure.
This is a line from the book. Hidden in an unknown corner of Inner Mongolia is a toxic, nightmarish lake created by the world's thirst for smartphones. So what are you talking about here?
Yeah, so this refers to a waste pond at a rare earths facility in Inner Mongolia. And rare earths are a group of 17 minor metals found on the periodic table, and their name is a bit of a misnomer. They're not actually rare. What's rare is to find them in large quantities. One of those is in Inner Mongolia. It's a deposit that's commingled with iron ore, and China has wisely decided to not only extract the iron ore to make steel, but then also basically kill two birds with one stone and also extract the rare earths, so it helps reduce your costs. But rare earths are an extremely they are very environmentally deleterious to extract and refine and produce. They can be, depending on the geological deposit. And the United States has very strong ESG standards around rare earths refining. That portion of the book that you just read is basically meant to underscore the different approaches in China. You've got this giant waste pit that's bigger than New York Central Park, which is just massive when you think about it. And that store is the muddy detritus of the mining extraction process that is just going to be there in perpetuity unless somebody pays gargantuan amounts of money to clean it up. That would never fly in the United States or, I would imagine, Australia or Canada. And it points to how China has used its various levers, including ESG standards, to sort of leapfrog the rest of the world when it comes to ESG. The book chronicles the history of the Mountain Pass mine in Southern California, which is on the border of California and Nevada. And this mine had various owners over the course of its history, but it is so important to the U.S. and the global economy because it was the world's largest supply of rare earths for years, really. In the years after the Second World War, up until about the 1990s, it was the primary source of these rare earth metals. And rare earths are used in a lot of different electronics, but in small quantities. They're sort of like the pepper added to a steak, if you will. A great common example is your cell phone. It vibrates because of a rare earth magnet. And wow. That magnet takes the power from the battery in the cell phone, and it basically turns that power into motion. In an electric vehicle, you don't have a motor per se, but what you do have is a magnet that takes power from the battery and turns your wheels, turns it into motion. And right now, though, China is the world's largest producer and consumer and processor of these. That mine that I mentioned in Southern California, it is digging rock out of the ground right now, but it ships that rock to California for processing. It is trying to process more right there in California, and it's having various degrees of success. But the book chronicles the journey of the company that buys this asset out of bankruptcy a few years ago and tries to basically revive this key part of American energy independence, and looks at sort of the complexities around this and how China has used its control of this sector really as an economic weapon to, I would argue in the book, help propel its economy to the second largest in the world.
And so we're thinking about the question of what is the cost to have this stuff extracted from the ground? Do we want these supply chains to be domesticated? You've just given this example of the mine in China and their different environmental standards. It's worthwhile to ask the trade-off, you know. If the alternative to getting rid of the buckwheat flour is an open pit of toxic waste bigger than Manhattan, or Central Park at least, are we still making an equal trade-off here? And of course, it's an open question, but looking at the different standards for how environmental regulations are actually enforced in the mining of these materials is another big part of the book, because we don't have to go into it. But obviously throughout the Congo, we were talking offline before of the retail cobalt mining. There's plenty of examples throughout Indonesia, plenty of examples throughout India. I imagine throughout Latin America as well. Talk about what happened in Bernardino in Brazil. Just as another horrific example of the downside of worse regulation, worse practices in the extraction of these materials, which we're saying we don't want to happen at home.
Bernardino was a tragedy. There's no way around it. This was a massive tailings dam facility at an iron ore mine owned by Vale, which is one of the world's largest mining companies. And a tailings dam stores the muddy detritus of the mining process. So most mines have what's known as a grade, and the grade can be around 1% or less depending on the metal you're trying to extract. So a copper mine, for instance, might have a grade of 0.5%. That means for every 90, 95 pounds of rock you take out of the ground, you might get 5 pounds of copper if you're taking 100 pounds out of the ground. And so you got to do something with that 95 pounds that's not the copper. And so you basically store it in what's called a tailings dam. And because you use so much water in the mining production process, that tailings mix tends to be sort of gooey, almost like a mud pie. Remember when you were a kid, you made like a mud pie in your backyard. So you sort of end up stacking these mud pies on top of each other. And there is engineering that goes into it, but there's also a lot of risk that can go into tailings dam depending on how high you stack them. And this particular tailings dam in Brazil had been known for years to have structural issues, but those were swept under the rug. And the result was around lunchtime on a Friday, this tailings dam collapsed. And we have it on video. And it just looks like something out of a children's TV video. It just slowly disintegrates before you. But because this was hundreds of meters tall, the tailings dam was built into the side of a hill, it created this huge torrent of sludge that basically just rivered down onto this mess hall where workers were actually eating lunch. And so hundreds of people died. And this didn't have to happen, and nor was it at a small company. This was at a major mining company that should have put more resources into its engineering talent for tailings dam oversight. And so this sort of reinforced people's concerns about the modern mining industry, because the pushback from the industry for a while has been that we know how to operate safe mines. These are not your grandfather's mines. But when you have things like this happen at a major mining company, it does tend to raise questions about safety standards. And one of the chapters in the book that I look at is looking at this idea of what are the standards that we want to have for a modern mine. If we do think that we actually are going to have more mines, we can't just say no to all of these mines. We have to explore what are the standards by which we do mine. Mm. And there's this organization known as the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance that I'd heard of a few years ago and I wanted to learn more about. It was actually founded in part by Tiffany & Company, the jewelry company. You know, this is the iconic jewelry company that has these blue boxes. They made movies about Tiffany. You know, you buy engagement rings there and other jewelry components. But what the company realized is that it was really, really good at making jewelry. It was not really good at making gold or silver or copper or any of these other metals that it needed for the energy transition. It stuck to its knitting, basically. But what it didn't want to do is buy any of these metals or diamonds from places that produced them at low ESG conditions, or where workers made less than, the equivalent of $1 per day. And so it got together with other NGOs and it helped create this Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance known as IRMA. And IRMA doesn't really seem like it would work because you get mining companies, their customers, labor unions, indigenous groups, local NGOs and other people in a room. And you basically say, okay, what does the perfect mine look like? What does the mine of the 21st century look like? What are the standards for water and waste and free, prior, and informed consent and indigenous consultation that should be best practice for a mine? And this group, I should say, got a huge boost from Ford, BMW, Tesla, Volkswagen, and others that said, we want to support this initiative, and we want to know that when we expand our production of electric vehicles, that there's going to be enough metal certified by IRMA and audited by IRMA to be able to use in the production of our electric vehicles. And so it gave a huge turbocharge to this effort. And so where we are today in 2024 is that IRMA has been auditing mines across the world. And after the audit is complete, then results are publicly released on a website. So you, me, our friends, our colleagues can look up how a specific mine ranks on these IRMA standards. And I think that's going to be increasingly important as the energy transition accelerates, because one key metric that I think consumers are going to want to look at, especially with electric cars, is, okay, did the lithium and the copper and the nickel come from some other place on the other side of the world? Mm. What's the ESG footprint for the metals in this car? Like, if I truly am getting a zero emission vehicle by going green, well, I want to know that the production of that vehicle was zero emission or as close to it as humanly possible. Mm. And an organization like IRMA really helps consumers have more information. And so I really wanted to chronicle the history there. And I got to spend some time with Mike Kowalski, the former CEO of Tiffany, and hear through his vision for what IRMA could be and bake that into that chapter there. So that was really important for me to talk about the standards by which we operate mining, because things like Brumadinho stood out as huge red flags for Kowalski and others. And they said, this can't happen again, but we also need these critical minerals. Mm. So what are the best ways that we know how to push the industry in the right direction?
Are there any instances that you came across of people exploiting some type of greenwashing, not accusing that of IRMA, but maybe similar auditing companies? You know, the idea that you can just get the independent auditor's tick of approval?
Well, the accusation has been there that some of the certification schemes sponsored by either certain corporate entities or investor entities might not be as widely understood or as clear-cut as people would want them to be. What I found intriguing about IRMA was that the standards by which all mines are audited are publicly released, and then when the audit happens, the results are publicly released as well. So people can compare both sides and say, okay, here are the standards for, say, water. How did this mine stack up on the water side? And if the ranking or if the audit found a low grade, you know, there's certainly areas for improvement there. But now you and I know that this mine ranked here on this audit in this, this is how it was ranked when it comes to water. And so it brings a level of transparency there. And then to your point that there have been some accusations that maybe some certification schemas in the past were not as transparent as they could be. But here, I mean, it's hard to cheat on IRMA because everybody knows the rules of the road. And when the audit's released, it's public for everyone to digest.
So the optimistic conclusion might be, me in a very developed Western economy that has, you know, other means of creating productivity at home, we don't actually have to produce these goods locally, and we can also live guilt-free knowing that if we do buy it from China, there are companies like IRMA that are going to ensure that it's coming at a great environmental cost, which is to say very small environmental cost, and that the standards are just as good as I would have hoped on my own shore. And therefore, all of these problems in between were just growing pains to get to ultimately what is a nice conclusion.
I mean, I think the consumer is going to want to know that a small child wasn't involved in the supply chain for the cobalt in the product that they buy, or that people are paid a living wage, right? And so IRMA is a huge step forward in that because it brings transparency to an industry that for too long has not seen transparency as something key and important and as part of important totally. Consumer dialogue. And so it's a huge step forward in the right direction, and it gives consumers one more tool as part of their decision-making around how they buy products that they use every single day. I mean, I think, Ryan, a great analog there is also the apparel industry. I think for a long time, people didn't necessarily think through where the shirt that they bought came from. They just, and maybe on a broad concept, were like, yes, I don't like the idea of a sweatshop, you know, but they hadn't really sort of thought through, okay, well, if it says made in a country on the other side of the world, what does that mean? But then it was a few years ago, there was a giant fire at a sweatshop in Bangladesh, and people were shocked at all the deaths, and also that many of the brands that they buy every single day relied on that sweatshop to produce a lot of these articles of clothing. And so you're starting to see in the apparel industry, consumers slowly start to move in this direction of being more informed about how the products that they buy every single day for clothing are produced. And I think we're going to start to see that more and more happen in the electrification space. And I think organizations like IRMA move the ball forward.
Yeah. Regarding the apparel parallel, it is a pretty cynical take, but I think there is a lot of evidence that despite being more informed through the hyperconnectivity and the massive information, it actually doesn't move the needle when it comes to the ultimate consumer behavior. Regarding Shein specifically, I think they're the largest fast fashion house in the world. It's very well known. It's documented. It's all over TikTok. The same people that will buy the Shein will see all the bad stuff about it. But I don't have really any evidence for that. But I've had on a guest several times, a guy called Mike Mistrati. Had him on a guest once, spoken to him several times. And he's dedicated his whole career to investigating the supply chains of cocoa throughout, you know, West Africa. Every time he goes there, without failure, he will discover not only an instance of child labor, but typically child slavery, and typically the worst conditions imaginable, kidnapped from villages, abused, everything. And it's like, it's traceable every time. These small micro farms sell to a broker, that broker gathers a bunch, sells to a bigger broker, and ultimately it's in our chocolate bar, and it still has the Rainforest Alliance, and it still has the No Child Slavery. It's got all the you know, Irma ticks of approval equivalent. Anyway, just to say that these things, and this is a very cynical take from the end consumer, I think having known all of this, it actually doesn't move the needle much for behavior. The real thing that moves the needle is cost.
Well, I would say, to carry your cocoa analogy into the green energy space here, we don't have that level of transparency now that this gentleman that you just referenced does for the cocoa space. And in that book, I have a chapter talking about leaf blowers, which might sound whimsy and innocuous, but I wanted to take the idea of electrification beyond transportation, beyond electric vehicles for the reader. And a few years ago, I got a house with a backyard, and I decided to go all electric on lawn care. You know, very sort of American suburban dream here. And leaf blowers used to be powered by two-stroke engines. I mean, they still are, depending on where you buy them. But some cities and other jurisdictions are outlawing them because two-stroke engines basically combine oil and gasoline, and they spew out this gnarly mix of pollutants that are just horrible for the environment. So a lot of people are saying, you should get an electric leaf blower, go electric. And so I did. And I got to tell you, I got it just as I was starting to really think through this book and start the writing for it. And so that brought me down this rabbit hole of, okay, well, where do the metals come from inside this leaf blower? If getting an electric leaf blower is truly better for the environment and this is the way to go, well, then where did the cobalt and the nickel and the lithium and the copper inside it come from? And Ryan, I got to tell you, like, I got all resources at my disposal, especially with my day job at Reuters, but I couldn't figure out where this stuff came from at all.
That's hilarious.
And so, like, you know, the cocoa might be traceable in the example you just shared, but right now it is not the same path through the metals that are in this leaf blower or any other device that is out there. Just magnify it by the millions and millions of electronic devices that we use every single day. And you just really got to see that this is an issue that is so much more than transportation. And so there's no traceability right now. Irma is only audited a handful of mines. And so if we really want to get to critical mass, we've got to demand this transparency as consumers.
Well said. Well said. I mean, that seems like a giant...
information hole. Yeah, it's...
Considering that a lot of those same rare earth minerals or materials that you trace down in your electric leaf blower exist in what, you know, our microwave, our television, yep, our computers, our phones, potentially our cars, the same stuff at our office. I mean, how often every day are we manipulating material that has an extremely bloody supply chain?
We don't know. That, I think that's the short answer, which is sort of terrifying when you think about it. The not knowing is the worst part. We can demand more transparency. I mean, right now we have a lack of transparency. We don't know where a lot of these building blocks come from. And we don't know if a 7-year-old in the Congo took the cobalt out of the ground that went into the global supply chain that made it into these everyday goods that you and I use. And right now, it would behoove us, I would argue, to demand more transparency and also to be thinking through strategically, well, if we had supplies of cobalt, for instance, just to carry the example forward, that were not just reliant on the DRC, what would that mean for ESG standards in that country and elsewhere? I'm not necessarily saying that if we have more cobalt mining, say, in the United States, that would decrease the child labor usage in the Congo. I hope that it would, but I'm not sort of just saying one will sort of lead to the other. But what I am saying is that by increasing more production regionally or domestically, we are helping to ensure higher ESG standards for the products that we buy every single day.
Right. But then to our point earlier, is the trade-off that we want to insist for that, or rather rely on Irma and these other independent third parties that do a good job at creating the incentive for someone abroad to meet the ESG standards of us in another country? But then, I mean, as you said very explicitly in the beginning, like, the complexity of this is kind of unweavable to a certain degree, and you just have to live with bad options at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, I think there are ways forward here that can be clear for us all as consumers, you know, demanding higher standards for manufacturers, demanding more transparency, saying that we want our products produced ethically, and then having a debate about the standards. And also, I mean, you alluded to this a bit earlier, Ryan, we have to be having a debate around price. What are the prices we're willing to pay? I think for too long, we've been used to the lowest price available, which makes sense. We all have finite pocketbooks. We all have to make that dollar stretch. But if we want a lot of these electronic gadgets and gizmos, you know, are we willing to pay more for nickel that's ethically sourced and that perhaps didn't involve the destruction of a rainforest? Some people might say no, they're not willing to. And that's part of the debate, I would say, that we should be having. Or should we be having more nickel production in places with ESG standards that we would consider acceptable in the West? You know, for instance, the United States has one nickel mine right now, and it has no nickel refining capacity. And that one nickel mine in the United States is going to be basically depleted in the next year or two. And so where is the U.S. going to get nickel? Now, there are some projects that are on the drawing board in the United States, one of which in particular has got a big contract with Tesla. But there's just too much nickel on the global market right now, partly due to Indonesia, which has really low ESG standards for how it extracts nickel. So the market is flooded right now. So the economics don't make sense to necessarily start or announce a new nickel project in the U.S. or the Western world. In Australia, we've seen BHP mothball some of its nickel projects because of this price effect by these Indonesian projects. And so this has a direct effect on the amount of nickel that goes into the global supply chain. And this is nickel that's going in there that is not produced at standards that we would consider acceptable in a Western country. You know, if I said to somebody in the United States, I want to dig a nickel mine by tearing up a giant forest, it would probably not get that far. But we are implicitly saying that we're comfortable with that if we continue to buy more nickel there. So I would add this to the other pile of choice. There's a lot of choices to be made here.
And also, just to, you know, sprinkle on a little bit more complexity, from the mining company's perspective, my goodness, the type of complexity and hoops you have to jump through just to get permission to do this in the first place, you know, sourcing all the different types of financing, sourcing all the different types of insurance, taking on the giant risk that you might actually not even find something once you get down there. What if you commit to all of this project, then 2 years later, the commodity price for that good you're going to dig out has fallen through the floor? It's like, just to get to the point where you can dig it out is such an achievement. It can move the value of your company so significantly. You can understand from their perspective, their incentive, why they see a buckwheat flower and they say, hey, look, we're going to be digging this out irrespective of your, you know, cultural or environmental attachment to this place. So again, more complexity.
Yeah, you could definitely see that. One chapter in the book looks at the Morenci mine in Arizona, and this is North America's largest mine of any type. And I included that because I wanted to show the reader an example of an active mine that's been around for more than a century that produces a vital building block for our modern society, copper. And most of the book looks at projects that are proposed but have not yet received green lights, that projects that have a lot of the tension, hence the title, The War Below. But the Morenci project was an example of a company that has been operating this for a very long time and has gained social license to operate and has worked with local indigenous groups. And so it is doing all of those things, and nobody's perfect. I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. But this mine certainly is not perfect, but it has been doing this successfully to provide copper for the U.S. and global economy. And so I wanted the reader to get a sense of scale, of place, and of the complexity that goes into this project, to your point, that these mines don't just show up one day. They take decades to really develop, and they involve gargantuan amounts of earth moving in order to produce copper.
It's enough to give you an immense appreciation for just the logistics and organizational power of getting it done in the first place.
Yeah.
Then it goes into the globalized supply chain, which is another huge bout of appreciation. Like Ed Conway's book does that really well.
Great book.
But okay, 9 minutes, you absolutely must leave.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
I've got a
No problem. Then let's wrap it up.
Okay.
How quickly can you do this? How has protectionism shaped the mining of these materials? Subsidies, quotas, tariffs?
Well, these commodities are definitely global markets, and gosh, I'm hesitating to answer because we're in an election year, Ryan, here in the United States, and so tariffs will invariably pop back up into the general discussions among various voters. What I would say is that we've not seen tariffs on critical minerals to a large degree coming from the United States. What we have seen is some technology being limited for export by China, for instance, the rare earth technology, as well as some minor metals, germanium, gallium, graphite, some moves to protect exports there. So that does have an effect, of course, on the price on the global market, as well as the availability. And because China has cornered the market for many of these critical minerals, what it does has an outsized effect on how the whole energy transition happens. And because it's a major supplier right now, it's very much in the driver's seat. So if other countries besides the United States took moves around some critical minerals, it perhaps would have less of an effect than what China is doing. And I would argue, and do argue in the war below, that that is one reason to increase regional production, whether that's in North America or Europe or South America or elsewhere. That only could help further solidify energy independence, or at least strive for it. I don't necessarily think the concept of energy independence is completely achievable or even perhaps desirable, but the idea of moving towards some kind of diverse supply of these critical minerals is perhaps helpful. You know, the United States has the Inflation Reduction Act, which has gone a long way to help increase the electric vehicle supply chain and the green energy transition here in the country. But that doesn't necessarily just support domestic mining projects or projects in the United States. It also supports projects at countries that have U.S. free trade deals. So countries like Australia or Chile, or I believe there's 13 others. And so that does help other places around the world.
All right, Ernest, we got to we're coming to an end here. We got to rush through the last four in a few minutes.
Sure.
Anything interesting about Robert Friedland that you've come across in your research?
Robert Friedland, huge icon in the mining industry. I would say he is a legend in terms of his advocacy and leadership in the space, and his advocacy especially for people thinking through where we get the building blocks of our everyday lives. You know, I mean, I would say his argument, his arguments, plural, whether it's on Twitter or now known as X or other forums, to think through where we get the building blocks of our everyday lives very much echoes and evokes my key theme of the war below, which is choice. And so I think Robert continually beating this drum around where are we going to get copper, where are we going to get the other critical building blocks for this energy transition, I think are important parts of the conversation.
And personal anecdotes, experiences with him?
We've met multiple times at some conferences, and we've had good conversations.
Okay, nice, nice. It's one of my great ambitions to interview him in Singapore. He's been on my list of dream guests ever since I started the show.
Okay, okay.
Three non-mining war below related. Let's see how quickly we can do them. What is the role, Ernest, that serendipity has played in your life?
Gosh, I think the ability to cover critical minerals was a great serendipitous moment. I was covering the oil and gas space for about 8 years and had a great opportunity to go all over the world, really, and cover that space for Reuters. I covered OPEC, several OPEC meetings, actually, from its headquarters in Vienna. I lived in North Dakota for almost 2 years covering the oil and gas industry and really enjoyed that. But before lithium or copper became cool, I had the opportunity to jump into covering the space for Reuters, and that was an awesome opportunity. This was about, I would say, 7 years ago, and thoroughly enjoyed it ever since, really diving into this space and helping folks understand really how these new evolving supply chains define their lives. And so I'd say it was a serendipitous opportunity that came up and I jumped at it.
Fantastic, mate. And also a brilliant example of serendipity sort of driving a huge outcome in your life. And it's also really cool that you've got to live through two rather monumental, you know, energy transitions of a sort.
Yeah.
And who knows, maybe geothermal will mark the third one.
Maybe be the third. Third time's the charm.
Totally. Your favorite fictional character?
You know, I'm a huge fan, and this might be a little niche for your audience, but I'm a huge fan of Marilynne Robinson. She's what I think and consider one of the best writers of our time. And she wrote this four-part book series. They're all fiction books, but she has a character who is an elderly minister, which might sound sort of provincial, but her writing is just it's very ethereal and very clear, and I've recommended her book to anyone. So the main book in the series is called Gilead. It won the Pulitzer Prize. Highly recommend it. And her character of John Ames is just brilliant. It's a masterclass in writing, the whole book, and it just speaks to how to write with I would say sort of a quiet grace and helping to understand people. And so her sense of people and place definitely informed my own writing.
Love that. I'll definitely be giving that a go. Finally, Ernest, a country you're particularly bullish on.
I'm bullish on maybe not a country specifically, but us as a people, as humanity. I think we have a lot of positives ahead of us. And I think if we come together and grapple with these tough choices, that we're going to be in a much better place. And I think we're starting to do that right now. And so these aren't issues that affect one country or another. It affects all of us. And so I wrote The War Below for everyone because I really think it's about a topic that affects us all. And so I'm bullish on us as species, really. You know, I think there can be some negativity, especially in the climate debate, about whether we're cooking ourselves to death, for instance, to use sort of an extreme term, or whether we're being ignorant around the risks to our planet. But I'm really optimistic that whether you're in the United States or China or Australia or any other country, that we as people are coming together to really help figure out what we want our world to become.
All right, mate. I'll let it slide because we don't have much time, but that's not a country.
You know, I love all my countries equally, so.
All right, mate. All right. Well, Ernest, phenomenal book. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me, and thank you for being so generous with your time and your answers.
Ryan, great to be with you. Appreciate the interest in The War Below and looking forward to future opportunities.
Oh, cheers, man.